Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. The show continues. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 4 o'clock. At 4 o'clock, our good friends over at Bradley Place, the TV side, will be talking on the early morning news from the TV side. And then at 5 o'clock, Bob Surratt, the legend, has your morning drive here on 720 WGN as the show continues. Coming up on the show, we are going to talk about some iconic Hollywood couples, because on this day in history, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward got married, and that's about as iconic and classic a Hollywood marriage and couple that you can get. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're going to talk space with Rod Pyle here in a second, and if you want to jump in with any of your thoughts on that and comments or questions, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Who requested the purple?
The purple.
Is that Deep Purple?
Rainbow?
Oh, that was Rainbow. Oh.
Yeah, that's coming to us from Chris.
Okay, Chris. Hey, by the way, this spring, Chicago's hometown baseball rivalry heads to Arizona. One lucky fan will win a trip for two to Phoenix, including airfare, hotel, and tickets to the Wintrust Crosstown Series game on March 13th. Register today at WGNradio.com/contest. That's WGNradio.com/contest. Sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, and presenting sponsor of the Wintrust Crosstown Series. So get to that website now and register. All right. We love to have this guy on. He visits with us usually once a month. He is an author, prolific author, a space expert, and the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. And he joins us to talk all things space. 312-981-7200 for talk or text with your questions space-related. Let's welcome Rod Pyle. Hi, Rod.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
All right, sir. How are you?
I'm good.
All right. As we always do, for people who might not listen on a regular basis, tell everybody who you are and how you got into what you do.
All right. So I was born a little bit before NASA was, and grew up with NASA being a major interest, and really got fascinated with the thing space by the middle of the Gemini program, so mid to late 1960s, really, and was just completely enraptured by the whole Apollo program. And my parents said either the foresight or lack of attention to let me stay home and watch the moonwalks, which is really exciting. And that was way better than going to high school.
Yeah.
So that was great fun. And it got me kind of interested in this as a lifelong trajectory. So I went off to school to major in astronomy at UCLA and met up with the advanced calculus and realized that I was either going to be a very, very sub-average scientist, or maybe I could do something on the communication side. So that kind of started me down the path. So I made documentaries for the History Channel, and I worked in visual effects on Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, the second one. I'm not old enough for the first one, at least not to have worked on it, and ended up writing books in the 2000s, and I've done 17 of them, despite your claims of tens of thousands, which I like better, by the way, because the royalties would be great.
Yeah.
If I got a dollar a book per year, I'd be a happy camper.
Yeah. People can check out rodpylebooks.com for more info. And
or Amazon or wherever. Yeah.
All right. Well,
we're all over,
Rod,
the place.
Lots of stuff to talk about. It's always fun to catch up and just have some fun talking about things. But before we do, we had a very, very tragic anniversary yesterday.
I guess it is yesterday now, isn't it?
Chicago. Yesterday.
1986, explosion of the Challenger, which was one of the first shuttle orbiters manufactured and flown early in the program. And the shuttles have been flying since 1981, and this was January in Florida. It was a very, very cold morning that they were trying to launch, and there's a lot of pressure to keep the shuttle program on pace. NASA had, by virtue of necessity, because it's how you have to do things when they were cutting money after the end of the moon program, so this was all being built in the late 70s, they promised the federal government, look, we'll fly this thing as often as every week, and it'll do all this stuff inexpensively, and it'll be reliable and cheap. And nonetheless, the Nixon administration and others started cutting budgets, and one thing led to another, and the crux of it was, you had this compromised design for a spacecraft, a human-rated spacecraft, that was supposed to keep this incredibly tight schedule. So there's a lot of pressure to fly and to launch that morning. Unfortunately, it was so cold that it froze down the rubber seals in between the sections of the two solid rocket boosters that were the main propulsive force in the first stage of the shuttle, if you want to call it that. And one of those seals was breached, and blowtorch hot flame came out of it, ended up cutting one of the attachment points to the main shuttle tank, that big orange tank that most people probably remember, and that solid rocket booster pivoted into the tank and punctured it, and the fuels ignited, and the whole thing went up. And that was that. So it was about, I think, 90 seconds into flight when that happened, and there were no survivors. So very sobering moment. And I think that's, you know, in the historical context, that was when people kind of realized this wasn't as foolproof as NASA had made it look for a long time. We had really only had one space accident, quote unquote, that didn't happen in space. It happened on the Earth where people died, which was Apollo 1 back in 1967. And so this suddenly, it all came crashing down, so to speak, and NASA looked fallible. So it was a big moment and a big pivot in the program, and a lot of things changed after that.
Yeah. We lost seven crew members. There were no survivors. We lost seven crew members that day.
Very sad, very sobering.
Yeah. I remember where I was, and I think everybody does. I think everybody remembers where they were, you know, when the shuttle disaster happened. I know a lot of people, a lot of kids were in school. You know, we've talked about it, you know, in the past here on the show about, you know, where were you when these big moments happened? And, you know, a lot of kids were in school. They wheeled in TVs, you know, to watch it. Some kids were let go to go home. You know, I was stocking shelves at a grocery store here. We have a chain in Chicago called Jewel, and I worked there for a bunch of years, and I was stocking shelves. When the manager came up from downstairs in the break room, there was a small TV down in the break room, and he came up from downstairs and said, "You guys, take a break here from because we had a morning crew. We would, you know, take pallets of grocery items and put them on shelves and stuff, and they were like, take a couple of moments here because a tragedy just happened, and you might want to, you know, you might want to come downstairs and check it out." And that's when we saw that the Challenger had exploded. And I'll never forget it. I mean, I vividly remember being standing in our break room watching it on TV.
I just barely, as a little kid, remember hearing the news about the assassination of President Kennedy in the Sears parking lot. And then for Challenger, I was working at a commercial production company, made TV commercials, and I was running the production office, these five separate production entities all coordinated through. And I got a call from my boss upstairs saying, "Shell exploded," and he hung up. I was like, "What? Huh?" So we, same thing, you know, we went in another room and turned on the TV, and there it was. And I was certain when I saw it, just from what I knew about the shuttle, that it had been one of the main rocket engines that were actually on the orbiter, because if you knew much about those, you're always afraid, because of the incredibly high pressures and turbine speeds, that a turbine was going to fragment or something. But as it turned out, it was the solid rockets, which should have, by all rights, been one of the most reliable part of it. But as it turned out, it had that kind of fatal design flaw. And they did end up fixing it. But it's one of those things, you know, it did expose a lot of kind of managerial ossification that had been happening in the agency, I guess you could call it that, and there were mistakes being made. And, you know, there have been recommendations not to launch from the engineers at the contractor and people within NASA, but management said, "No, we got to go. It's safe enough." And they found out the hard way. And then, as you probably remember, they had that board review where Richard Feynman, the great physicist from Caltech, famously immersed a piece of that O-ring rubber material in a glass of ice water and held it there for a minute. And then in front of cameras snapped it in half and said, "That's it. That's what happened." And everybody went, "Wow." Yeah. I mean, what a demonstration.
Yeah. Wow. Our space expert, Rod Pyle, joins us here. You can check out rodpylebooks.com. We got a lot more to talk about with Rod as we continue here on the Nick DiGilio Show. If you want to jump in here, we'll take your calls or texts at 312-981-7200. Our conversation with Rod Pyle continues. The Nick DiGilio show continues here on 720 WGN live in the Skyline studio. Coming up later on, after 3:30, we will have another round of Know Your Onion. That's where Tom will read you a newspaper headline, and you have to decide whether it's real or it's from The Onion. Wildcard Wednesday continues. That's the theme for you picking the music that we hear. Any artist, any song, anything. Who requested that?
This is coming to us from Ike, little Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine.
All right.
From the movie Cobra.
God.
Yeah, dude.
Cobra.
No.
Okay. No. All right, fair. No. Best part of that movie is his car. All right. And, the Nick DiGilio Show continues. Rod Pyle is our guest. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra, and a space expert. And if you have questions, we would love to hear from you. Phone lines, text lines are open, 312-981-7200. And we continue with Rod. Rod? All right.
And welcome to Coast to Coast. Oh, sorry, I got wrong show.
Yeah, no, wrong show. Rod, you know, before we were just discussing the Challenger disaster. Do you remember... there was a movie that came out a couple of months after the disaster, and nobody went to see it, called Space Camp.
And it was, I'm sad to say, I was one that did go.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it, people didn't want to see, you know, because it was such a tragedy what happened in real life.
Yeah.
People didn't want to see a movie that would even bring that, you know, bring that memory back. So I just remember the movie being, you know, I just remember the movie being a major box office bomb simply because of when it was released.
Well, I think it was also a major box office bomb because it wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't very good. No.
You probably saw it, right? I mean, the whole thing about, you know, the kids are training on the shuttle and, oh, my God, one of the solid boosters is lit off. We have to let it launch. Will they make it? It was such an absurd. I went to see it because I'd gone to space camp 2 years before that in the first group of adult journalists.
Okay.
So they had us eating chili mac and crackers and sleeping in the little wooden bunks that were only about 5.5 feet long and stuff. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, I really dug it. It was kind of primitive then because it was a long time ago. But it was actually a blast. So I would see the movie thinking, well, maybe it'll, you know, harken back to some of that fun we had at space camp. And it just kind of, I felt it kind of went off the rails.
Yeah.
But good point, you know, that you make is that it was just too soon and too tender.
It was.
And lesson learned, yeah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it wasn't a very good movie. I mean, I did end up, you know, I saw it. You know, because I was at that time, I was, you know, I just become like a film critic at that point when that happened. I was just recently added to Roy Leonard's show reviewing movies, so I had ended up going to a lot of press screenings. And at the press screening, everybody felt a little weird just watching it. And then, it was a very strange time. But yeah, no, not a very good movie. The timing of it could not have been worse. So.
Well, and I suppose at that point it was too late to change it, but I thought it felt rather insensitive if you didn't think back to the
you know,
the production schedule.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just to have it about the shuttle, but to have it be about this emergency with a solid rocket booster that causes things to take off because you can't shut them off.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that is exactly the wrong note to be sounding
absolutely
for these tone deaf people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was tough watch. Yeah.
You mentioned you went to space camp. You threw out a couple of details. What was that like? Was that it was for journalists?
Yeah. So it was still. They now have adult sessions. You can do corporate retreats there and team building exercises and stuff. But at the time, it had only been around for a couple of years, and it was mainly aimed for kids. But they said, you know, we're going to let some journalists come out here, and I wasn't a journalist yet, but I had a friend that was, so he got me a pass to go. And it was great fun, but, you know, it was kind of like going and playing on the playground with your kid. You know, everything's a little undersized and not really made for adults. But the cool part was they had a full-size kind of low-fidelity plywood shuttle simulator, big chunk of a shuttle, not the whole thing, obviously. And they had a bunch of leftover equipment. I think it was from the Gemini program, some of it, training equipment. So they had, like, if you've ever played air hockey, they have a giant version of an air hockey table that's a whole room, and they had this armature that you strapped into, and so you were supposed to, it simulates at least two axes of zero G. It's frictionless, so you try and hand over your hand over to a piece of the shuttle fuselage to do something simulating a spacewalk. And if you miss a hand grip, you go drifting off into the ether. And then, you know, one of the counselors will come out and say, okay, space camper, try again. And the best part for me was, well, I mean, they gave us cool blue jumpsuits, which don't fit anymore, but I like that.
Yeah.
But one of the most thrilling parts was they had a three-axis trainer, which is that thing. Remember First Man, that big gizmo that they put him in the beginning where it spins in three different directions at once?
Yeah.
They had one of those.
Oh.
They said, okay, everybody's got to do this.
Oh.
We kind of looked at each other. So I said, okay, I'll go first. And it was Space Camp then was in Huntsville, right next to the museum at the Rocket Center.
Got it.
So it was in the public wing of the museum on this little stage, because I guess, I don't know if they let people, regular people do it, or if it's just on display. So they marched us out there in little blue jumpsuits and strapped me in, and I did 90 seconds on it or something. And it's pretty disorienting, because it's moving at random in these three different directions all at once at a fairly high clip. So they stopped it, and I got off. And I kind of staggered towards the edge of this little stage, and I knew I was going to heave at any moment. I look out, and here's this mid-40s nun with all these school kids from some Catholic school standing there looking up at the spaceman. And I thought, if I hurl on a nun, you know, I know I'm going south no matter what happens. So I managed to kind of just do a little mouth regurgitation and hold it down and smile and wave and run off. But,
nice.
That was exciting.
That's pretty cool.
It was fun. I hear it's been upgraded a lot. It's much higher fidelity because, you know, I think they're running the shuttle docking simulator on a Commodore 64 computer or something. It was really pretty low res. So I hear now it's sensational. It's not that much. It's a few hundred dollars, maybe $400 for a couple of days. So.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it from what I've heard about it since then.
Author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra, Rod Pyle is with us. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here on 720 WGN. If you have any questions space-related, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rod, here is William joining us. Go ahead, William.
Thanks for taking my call. Rod, I got a question for you. I remember back in high school when they always told us that energy is never created. You can change the state of it, but you can't destroy it. And so my question was, like, if over the years we've been removing oil from the core of the earth, and you remove water from the core of the earth, or you remove coal from the core of the earth, whatever you take from the core of the earth, does that change the spin, the rotation, or the orbit of the planet?
Nick, where do you get all these really smart listeners from?
I don't know.
So there's kind of a geophysics question for you. So I did take a lot of geology in college, but I'm not a scientist, so I'll just say that up front. My sense of this is all these deposits are really, when you look at the cross-section of the Earth, these deposits are really, really close to the surface. And they're so minute, as big as they are, they're so minute compared to the mass of the Earth, which gets more and more intense because it's compressed down as you get towards the center where this big molten magnetic iron core is. So I don't think it would change anything. You'd have to take out a lot more mass than that. As much as it's been over, you know, what, 110, 120 years since the Industrial Revolution now, I don't think it's had any effect. But that's a question for a geophysicist who could probably clear his throat a couple of times and, you know, give you something out 14 decimal points that would tell you exactly what changed. Yeah,
that's a good answer, William. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to continue with Rod Pyle here on 720 WGN, space expert, author, journalist. If you have a space-related question or comment, 312-981-7200. We're going to continue our conversation with Rod Pyle as the Nick DiGilio Show moves on.
Dominique, notre père, combattit les albigeois. Dominique, Nicanique, s'en allait tout simplement. Routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Certains jours, un hérétique par des ronds.
Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. Every morning, you pick the music that we hear coming back from commercials and news. We have a different theme every morning, and this is Wild Card Wednesday, so that means any artist, any song, anything, who requested that.
That's coming to us from the 312. It's the Singing Nun?
Yeah. You're not familiar with the Singing Nun?
I'm woefully unfamiliar with the Singing Nun.
Yeah, she was a real thing.
So just
had a guitar, was on all the talk shows, on the talent shows, all that stuff. Singing Nun.
Singing Nun.
Released albums.
What will they come up with next?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, somebody requested it. So there it is. The Nick DiGillo Show is continuing here, and Rod Pyle, our space expert, author, and journalist, is here. Rod, remember the Singing Nun?
I do. It took me a minute to put together why we were listening to something from the Singing Nun. I guess that was a nod to my ear regurgitation experience.
It's the timing of that was pretty conspicuous, because we have a theme on Wednesday mornings on the show where our listeners pick the songs that we play during commercial break, and Someone just happened to pick that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Yeah.
I'm a believer now.
Yeah, there you go. It's Rod Pyle joining us. If you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200 as we continue. 312 area code, send in a text here, Rod. It's Steve who says, I watched the documentary a while back on the Cassini space probe, and I believe they said it reached a speed of 70,000 miles per hour when it plunged into Saturn's atmosphere. That had me wondering if Rod knows what the highest speed that has been reached by a man-made object launched into space.
I think it was over 130,000, but I'd have to go back and check. And I think it was the Parker Solar Probe, if I remember right, because they needed to, was it Parker?
Mm.
Pretty sure it was Parker, because they had to get these big speeds to get it in the proper trajectory. But, Cassini was really hurtling, because it had done a bunch of passes way out past the rings, and then they were doing something they towards the end there that they hadn't tried at all, which was making passes between the rings of the planets. There's a lot of miles there, but it's still something that you don't want to do with your spaceship, because you don't know how there may still be some faint ring crud in that area, and you don't want to run into it, right? So they were making those because they knew that it was nearing the end, and then finally it just took that right turn, plunged in the atmosphere, and broke up. But boy, it's funny that you bring this up now, and I wonder which documentary you saw. I think there was one called The Farthest that won a whole sweep of awards and got all kinds of attention about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Which, it's sensational documentary. But I just was at a presser for Cosmos last week or the week before for the new season, the third season of Cosmos, and one of the clips I was able to see a package of was from an episode on Cassini. And I mean, it's written, this is Brana Braga and Andrew, and so Anne worked on the original Cosmos, and Brandon worked on Star Trek and a bunch of other shows, is quite talented. But they really played up the anthropomorphic part of, we're sending, Cassini's being told it's her time to die, and she has to, completely override all her programming and do what she was told to never do, which is commit suicide by plunging into the gaseous belts of Saturn. And I mean, it was very good. It was just a little maudlin, and I was clouding up a little bit because I remember being there at JPL at the end of that mission, and all we could see was this, I've told you this before, I think, but they had a radio signal graph up on the big screen, and a little spike in the middle, and as it began to break up in the upper atmosphere, that spike came down, and it just went flatline. It was like being next to a hospital bed when somebody goes, and it was really quite a kick to the gut. And I was just a bystander, If you'd worked on that thing for 10 or 20 years, it would have been overwhelming. But it was an incredible mission. It was out there for a long time. It did amazing stuff. So, yeah.
All right. Doc.
That's my very long answer.
No, that's okay. Doc says, by the way, it's Nick DiGillo here on the Nick DiGillo Show, continuing with Rod Pyle, our author, journalist, and space expert. Doc says, Nick, piggybacking on last night's show, is Rod aware of any reports of ghosts or paranormal activities in space or spaceships or on the space station? We had some paranormal hunters on the show last night, and so he wanted to. Have you ever heard of any paranormal activity out there?
You are such a Renaissance man for a radio host,
Yeah.
I have not, and that doesn't mean that there hasn't been reports of things. I mean, at least by design, everything that happens in the American space program has been pretty open to the press, but that doesn't mean that there might have been something muttered at some point that wasn't made public.
Yeah.
There was, I remember talking about Coast to Coast. I was doing a Coast to Coast a couple of years ago, and there were some questions about Apollo 10, I think it was. There was some weird ooey-ooey radio stuff going on the far side of the moon, and it turned out that the radios between the command module and lunar module, two separate spacecraft, were interfering with each other, and as you know, all kinds of weird stuff happens with radio frequencies, and you get RF leakage and so forth. So those guys thought, I think they made a joke about we're hearing songs from the aliens or something. There had been at one point some questions about, does that mean that there's a paranormal event happening? But I've never heard anything else along those lines.
Okay. All right. Just trying to tie in the show from last night. Here's Peter on WGN. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi there. You guys have talked about all sorts of wonderful, interesting things, and I have a comment and a question.
All right.
And I don't know which you want first.
Do the comment first, Peter.
Take your pick.
Okay, the comment has to do with the fact that mankind has been able to disrupt the orbit of, revolution of the Earth. There is a dam in China that now holds back so much water that it's created or a wobble in our planet's spin.
Are you familiar with that, Rod?
No, but that's intense.
Yeah.
So is this the Three Gorges Dam?
And it
created basically something the size of a small ocean behind it, right? If I recall correctly.
Right. That's the whole thing. It's created such a large body of water behind it that, the gentleman who was asking about boring into the planet and all, we don't go in far enough. I mean, the deepest holes are tiny diameter to get down that far, and they haven't removed enough material to off balance things. But
all right,
this
Peter,
body
what's your,
of water.
What's your question, Peter?
Okay, the question has to do with a book that came out in 1984 titled "The Greening of Mars," which I am looking at it right now. By James Lovelock and Michael Allaby. They offered up, in a fictional format, Carl Sagan loved it, though, they offered up a possible way of prepping Mars for human habitation by utilizing the missile rocket booster engines, I don't know how to describe it, the fuel units from retired missiles. They're now being used down in Texas in firing a power plant. But the idea he had, or these authors had, was to take, I think they were going to use four in a 3-1 arrangement for a first and second stage, and make a multi-stage rocket out of them. Uh-huh. And for a payload, they wanted to ship all the chlorofluorocarbons to Mars because those gases are extreme greenhouse gases.
Right.
And so, the whole idea was to pre-warm Mars.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Rod, what are your thoughts on that?
So it's interesting because that kind of ties in an inverse way to what he was talking about before, which is, we've been pulling stuff out of the Earth for over 100 years, and yet it's barely beginning to scratch the surface. And by the way, he's right. The Three Gorges Dam apparently did slow down the Earth's rotation by a tiny fraction. Mm. The problem is, Mars is a lot smaller than Earth, but it's still got a lot of land area and a large surface, and it just takes so much to affect it over time. When they talk about terraforming, which is what he's talking about, trying to make it more Earth-like, so warmer, and you start melting the ice, and then you get rain and all that, and open oceans like we think it had billions of years ago in the past. It just takes a massive effort, and a lot of stuff to do it. So that's why, for instance, when Elon Musk was talking about, and he made a series of shirts called Nuke Mars, which I had to buy one of them before they disappeared.
Right.
They're so bizarre.
Right.
The idea is you nuke the polar caps, you melt the water, and you can begin to build up clouds and so forth. But so it's an interesting idea, but you'd have to have, tens of thousands, if not millions, of rockets to do something like that.
Right. All right. Peter, thanks for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here on 720 WGN. My guest is Rod Pyle, author, journalist, and a space expert. And here is Trucker Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich. Are you there, Rich? We lost him. Okay.
We lost him.
Here's Paul
his
on
call
WGN.
Got interdicted.
Yeah. All right, Paul.
All right, yeah.
Go ahead.
If we have space stations on the moon, is it more likely that they get hit by meteorites and stuff as opposed to the Earth?
That's a good question. Now, just so you know, the station they're talking about now would be in an orbit around the moon, but they are talking about building lunar bases. So in lunar orbit, it might stand a slightly better chance of being hit by something from outside of the Earth-Moon system than it would around Earth, just because there's absolutely no resistance at ever in Earth orbit. There's a little tiny bit. However, Earth orbit is filled with so much orbital debris, millions and millions and millions of pieces of junk from exploded rocket stages and bits of frozen fuel and all that, that the odds are much higher of getting hit in Earth orbit, I would think, than in lunar orbit. On lunar surface, yeah, in theory, because you don't have this atmosphere that we have that burns up most of the meteorites that come plunging in. So if something the size of a pea or a golf ball, and there's stuff raining down on Earth all the time, day and night, were to enter the atmosphere, generally they burn up unless they're a little bigger. And even then, they don't hit with a lot of velocity because they slow down so much as they're coming in, unless they're very large. On the moon, since you have no atmosphere at all, if something comes hurtling in there, there's a better chance it's going to cause a little divot in your space station or your outpost, which is one of the reasons why they're talking about looking at putting stuff underground. There appears to be these big lava tubes, open caves on the moon and Mars, and we're thinking if we can put settlements down there, not only are they protected from any meteorite impacts, but they're also protected from radiation and other bad things that space wants to do that people don't like very much. So, good question.
Yeah. Okay. Paul, thanks. Rod Pyle is with us. We continue to talk about space and answer your questions as the Nick DiGilio Show continues. 312-981-7200 here on WGN. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here on 720 WGN, and it's Wild Card Wednesday. You choose the music every morning. Our theme is any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Elizabeth. It's the Harmonicats.
Oh, the Harmonicats. All right. All right. Hey, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And we are continuing our conversation as the show continues. Rod Pyle, who joins us once a month, is a space expert, author, journalist, and all-around good guy. And Rod is here. And Rod, we have Trucker Rich is back.
Oh, okay.
All right. Go ahead, Rich.
Good evening, Nick. I think the black helicopter's got me. I'm not sure.
All right.
But my grandmother passed away at the age of 101, and she went from little house in a prairie-style lifestyle to watching a man land on the moon. And she always said that whenever we launch somebody up into space, that we got weird weather for within the next 2 weeks. Is there any truth to that, or was that just an old grandmother's wives' tale?
I think that's a very sweet old wives' tale. There have been people that have actually expressed concern about the larger rockets and pollution, air pollution and so forth. The thing is, they're only in the atmosphere, in the lower atmosphere, a matter of a couple of minutes. They go so fast. By the time a rocket clears the launch tower in Florida, it's doing over 100 miles an hour already. So they're in the atmosphere for a very short period of time. And the newer ones, like the shuttle, was burning liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, which, as you know, doesn't, you know, they don't leave the kind of pollutants that the hydrocarbons like kerosene do. So it's doubtful that it had any effect on atmospherics.
Mm. Okay. All right, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's kind of like some of those old wives' tales, you know, and as a kid, you just kind of wonder,
yeah,
you know, and it was kind of amazing to think of what she lived through in her lifetime being 101, you know, so.
Yeah. All right, Rich.
I just got it. All right.
Thanks
guys. Yeah. Enjoy your show.
Okay. Thanks.
And, you know, just to wrap up that point a little bit, and I think we may have discussed this in the past, but when you look back and realize that we're about as far now from the Apollo moon landing, the first one, as it was from the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, it really feels like things have slowed down. And somebody, you know, of that age was around to see much of both of those things, and that must be really astounding. Yeah. And I feel like I'm halfway there. Actually, I am more than halfway there now, so I've seen a lot in my life.
Yeah. So the Navy now has some top secret information about UFOs, but they quote, it might cause exceptionally grave damage to national security of the United States if released. What's going on here?
So now the coast-to-coast reference makes sense, right?
Yeah.
That felt like a doofus. So this is going back to the what became known as the Tic Tac UFO story. This started in 2004 when there were some pilots off the USS Nimitz, I think they're off the coast of San Diego, that were doing maneuvers, and they spotted these UFOs, which just means unidentified flying objects.
Right.
Something in the air that's unidentified doesn't mean it's a flying saucer. Well, they moved in a very erratic way. They changed altitude very quickly. They were outrunning F-18s, which is a pretty fast airplane, and making these zigzaggy right-left-hand maneuvers, which, you know, normal air-breathing aircraft aren't supposed to do. They weren't showing up as having an exhaust plume on their infrared scopes. So it's kind of the classic UFO thing. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
So this video was kept quiet, but it ended up getting a clip piece of it got posted by somebody without Navy authorization. So the story broke, and then it kind of went away, and then it came back. And I think the most recent iteration was the Navy saying, look, we went ahead and declassified this because it was already de facto out there, but we're not going to give you the rest of it because there's a national security issue. So I called, because I knew we were going to talk about this, I called a friend of mine who's a retired Air Force colonel, another friend who's a retired pilot, Air Force pilot, and bounced this off of both of them, and they confirmed my thoughts, which I'd also gotten out of reading some other material, which is, I think the Navy's concern, you know, of course, it's tempting to immediately say, well, they're covering up the truth that's out there.
Yeah,
and all that.
Yeah.
I think the concern is that these may very well be some kind of machines by a foreign power that are being tested or doing observations or something, whether they're high-speed, high-tech drones or what, we don't know. And that the Navy's concern, the military's concern in general, DOD's concern, is that they don't want to release any more data than they have to because they don't want the other side to know what we may know about them.
Got it.
But that's a guess. But it's an educated guess. But yeah, it's just a guess. But the story is, it really, when you start digging into it, it's one of the more compelling ones we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, the headline alone is enough, you know, to
yeah,
to grab you.
Yeah, and people involved said, you know, they're on the military side said, we obviously being quoted off the record, but said there's a lot more to this than is out there, but nothing that absolutely screams alien encounter. You know, it's just one of those mysteries that comes up and has been coming up since the 40s when we first started noticing these things. I think what got a lot of news play for this was that some of the stuff coming out was from a group called the To the Stars Academy, that has one of their senior members, a former retired military guy, or he may have been a civilian, but he was employed by the Navy, who had been part of this thing. And so he went to be an advisor for this group, and so they were involved in releasing some material, and it was funded by Blink 182 frontman Tom, is it DeLong? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
I think?
Yeah.
So that, you know, that made it a little more newsworthy because now there's more and more interesting stuff stacking up. But it is, like I said, it is kind of a unique encounter, and the video is really compelling. I'm not a big believer in UFOs personally, but I can't say that I don't believe in them either because, you know, they're just unidentified. We don't know
right.
what's causing them. Personally,
right.
I think, you know, given the distances involved and the tech and all that, aliens are more likely to step out of my closet than land in a big metal ship, but who knows?
All right. Well, so that's a story that you can check out. By the way, you know, we're talking about a little conspiracy stuff here. Rob, 309 texts in, hey, Nick, ask your guest if he remembers the 1978 movie Capricorn 1. It's a very good movie. It's one of my favorites. We've talked about this movie extensively, Rod.
We have, and I love it. I mean, it's the one and only time I got to really like O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
What a shame. But it was a fun movie. It's really interesting because I think back the first time I saw it, I didn't see it for years. And the first time I saw it, I was kind of grinding my teeth because I thought, yeah, I couldn't stand the idea that they were promoting this idea of a NASA spaceflight hoax.
Yeah.
But it was done so well, and Sam Waterston is so great, and Brolin's so great.
Yeah.
And OJ, you know, for what he was doing is great. That whole routine, you know, the cat's on the roof when he's climbing the cliff. I mean, it was just such a hoot of a movie. You couldn't help but like it. So, yeah, I'd probably seen it, I don't know, 12, 15 times.
Oh,
now.
Man, I love it. I love that movie. I really do. And it's got such a great all-star cast. You just mentioned the guys who played the astronauts in it. But you got Hal Holbrook. You got Elliot Gould. You got Karen Black. It's such a great movie. It's so crazy. I mean,
That snappy Howard Hawks dialogue between Elliot Gould and Karen Black.
Yep.
You know, bam, 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 back and forth. Yep. Made it so much fun.
Yep.
And because we were going to talk about this, by the way, I decided to check out Project Blue Book on the History Channel.
Oh yeah.
Which I guess they're going off. I didn't realize they'd gone off into narrative dramatic programming now. Have you seen any of them?
No, I haven't.
You know, it's pretty well produced. It's all very washed out and sepia tone, and they're really going for the era, and the actors are good. They got the guy that played Littlefinger from Game of Thrones on there. And it's fun, but they're taking a lot of liberties with the facts, at least as we think we know them.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, it's the History Channel, so that's not something new for them. take a little bit of bending here and there. What I used to do work for them. You know, you got to try and generally play it straight and narrow, but there's always a squeeze to, you know, give us something we haven't seen before. Let's pump this fact up as much as we can. So there is an observance of the basic facts, but of course, this being a dramatic piece, they can do what they want. But it's worth checking out. It's kind of fun. I've only seen one episode so far.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. But yeah. I mean, we actually successfully, because of our discussion in the past, Rod, of the great movie Capricorn One. Tom ended up seeing it because, mm-hmm. and you did enjoy it.
Oh, it's genius.
Yeah,
it might be in my top 10 space movies at this point. No, it was a total blast to watch. That, like you said, the Howard Hawks dialogue stuff is spectacular, and it's just an interesting concept.
Yeah,
it's better than Interstellar, that's for sure.
Oh, come on, man.
Oh, I was waiting for that. I was going to say, did you think it was as good as Independence Day? But
yeah.
I didn't want to.
Oh, it's not nearly as good as Independence Day. No, not even close.
They're not even in the same camp, man.
I don't remember Elliot Gould shouting "Welcome to Earth."
Right, because Capricorn 1. Because Capricorn 1 is a good movie. That's why.
Yeah. No.
Must be it.
If only they blew up the White House, that would have been pretty cool in Capricorn 1. So that's why Independence Day is.
The thing about Capricorn 1. One is that it's this great sort of, you know, conspiracy movie that came out in the 70s, you know, when they were that genre was very, very, very popular at that time, you know, coming out of Watergate and stuff like that, a few years out of Watergate. So that was a very popular thing. But it's also just a really terrific action movie. Like, the action sequences are fantastic. And that there's a scene where Elliot Gould's brakes have been cut. His brake lines have been cut.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so beautifully filmed, and it's so exciting. He takes a dive into the drink, I just remember the first time I saw that movie, just being so thrilled by it. Every time I watch it, I think it's funny and thrilling and awesome. It's a terrific movie, and I'm glad that the listener texted that in about Capricorn One. So
directed by Pierre Hyams.
That's right. Yes.
Who gave us great expectations to expect great things from 2010.
Yes.
But didn't quite get there, did it?
No. I enjoyed 2010, but you know, I mean, I just try not to compare it to the Stanley Kubrick.
That's the thing. Yeah, if there had been no 2001 A Space Odyssey by Kubrick, 2010 would have been okay.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You got to love Roy Scheider.
You got to love
buddy,
Roy Scheider.
You know?
Yeah. So, all right, Rod Pyle. Yeah. Rod Pyle's with us, and our conversation continues. And the show continues. The Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN with the news next.
You call it jogging, I call it running around. You say you're losing weight, but you ain't lost a pound. While you're out jogging with your other friend, I'm home feeding the kids again. You call it jogging, I call it running.
The Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN, and Wild Card Wednesday continues. You request this the music that we play on the show every morning. Wild Card Wednesday just means any artist, any song, anything. What was that, and who requested it?
So that is the great Jimmy Buffett.
That was Jimmy Buffett?
Yeah, Jimmy Buffett. You call it jogging. And it's coming to us from Steve.
Oh, okay. All right. Not a big parrot head. At all, actually. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rod Pyle, author, journalist, space expert, joins us, and we continue our conversation. And, Rod, you ever hear that song before?
No, and there was no reference to margaritas or parrots or beaches or anything.
That's why I
would never guess Jimmy Buffett.
Me neither. Rod is with us. He is a journalist and a space expert, joins us once a month. We always talk space issues and more. If you have questions, it's 312-981-7200. Rod, a few more texts have come in.
Okay.
519 says, I remember a comet in the sky every day for a month or so when I drove to work for a night shift. Any more of those coming, or have you heard any coming for viewing?
There are one or two in the next few years, but they're all really faint. And I don't think they're naked eye objects, or if so, it's just a tiny blip. So, but probably you'd have to have binoculars. So I don't know when the next big naked eye one is coming. That's a good question. I went down in 84, 2 years before my space camp sojourn. I grabbed a bunch of friends and said, let's go see Halley's Comet. Because, you know, it only comes once a lifetime.
Yeah.
So we went down to Puerto Escondido in Mexico, which is kind of the lowest part of Mexico before it bends and goes down to Guatemala. And it looked kind of like a Q-tip in the sky. There wasn't much to it. I was expecting, I hadn't done a whole lot of homework, and so I figured, oh, my God, it'll be five times the diameter of the moon with the naked eye and all that. It just looked like a soggy little Q-tip. But it was fun to see, but... Yeah. Yeah, comets. Actually, I'll look that up while we move on to the next thing.
Okay. All right.
That'd be interesting to know.
815 says, any updates on James Webb scope?
Well, they're still working on it. So it's years behind schedule, and it's way over budget, and it turned out to be harder than we thought to do because it's a huge thing, for one thing. I think the mirror is something on the order of 8 feet in diameter. And it's in folding cells, so the mirror has to fold up to get inside the rocket fairing. So this mirror mechanism, when the telescope is finally launched out, and it goes way out beyond Earth orbit because it needs to be out where it can be in the dark and operate in infrared effectively. So these mirror panels have to unfold and lock in perfect configuration to make the spherical parabolic surface for the mirror, and it's got to be perfect. You know, it can't be a half a degree off or something, or it just won't work. And then you've got this enormous sunshade that has to deploy on the backside of it that makes it look like an Imperial Star Cruiser. It's this big kind of trapezoidal thing. And that is made out of, I think, Kevlar and a number of other fabrics that have to kind of unfold perfectly. They've got pulleys and cables and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So I've seen it twice down at Northrop Grumman in L.A. where they were working on it and getting the final bits and pieces put on. And I gather what hung us up for the last year and a half or so was testing this deployment mechanism, because where it's going, there's no Hubble service mission. You know, it's way, way out past lunar orbit. So where it's got to go, you can't fly out there and fix it if it doesn't work. So it's, as far as I know, it's still on pace for, I think, 2021.
Okay. Another story here. Two satellites might collide in Earth's orbit this week. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, so the Air Force tracks everything bigger than about a baseball in orbit, because they've got to know where things are, because they've got military satellites up there, so they need to make sure they're operating in a safe environment. Of course, we've got the space station to worry about in lower orbit, and a lot of other assets. So they're tracking, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of these things to make sure they're not going to impact with something that we care about that's still working.
Yeah.
So part of that is these old defunct satellites. And I think last time I checked, there's something like 40% of the satellites are in Earth orbit are actually functional. The rest are mostly dead. And that doesn't even count all the blown up stuff and natural bits of crap that get stuck in Earth orbit. So one of them is called IRIS. It's IRAS,
right.
An infrared satellite from 1973, telescope, about 2,400 pounds. The other one's GGSE, the gravity gradient experiment that the Air Force did, and that's smaller, that's about 200 pounds. But they're going to pass within 50 or 100 feet of each other, and normally when you're talking about, you know, being concerned about a near miss, you're talking about something on the order of miles. So this is really close.
Wow.
So if they smack into each other, it's going to make a bunch more, you know, two things now become 50 or 100 objects traveling in all kinds of different directions at high speeds. It's just that much more danger for anything you're trying to do in orbit. There's a lot of work going into trying to figure out how to get some of this orbital debris out of there, whether it's knocking it down from something in a higher orbit using a laser beam, or there's things with magnetic and electromagnetic induction. Even nets have been looked at. But ultimately, we've got to figure out some way to mediate some of this stuff, because there's basically this electron cloud around the Earth, if you will, of all this junk. My favorite concept is you scoop it up and you reuse it, because over the years, people have been kind enough to put all that metal up there. Let's build something with it. But that's a big technological hurdle.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. When's this supposed to happen?
It is today at, I think, 5:40 your time in the evening.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll see. We'll keep an eye on that.
They're saying it's about a 1 in 100 chance of collision, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on it and maybe do an update on tomorrow's show. It is the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here on 720 WGN here till 4 a.m. My guest is Rod Pyle, author, journalist, and space expert. And we're talking all things space. We've got a few more texts here. If you want to call in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Rita from Montana says, I told my grandkids there's more stars in the sky than grains of sand. Is that true?
To the visible eye, you can see, I think, something like 3,200 stars from one hemisphere at a time, and there's a whole lot more grains of sand. But if you're talking about stars in the universe, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you weren't like, she was not lying to her grandkids.
No, she wasn't telling her grandkids the weather changes because of a rocket launch. Which apparently is fictitious, but it's a cool story.
All right.
I like his grandma already, just hearing that
That's
one.
That's a good old Trucker Rich, man, calling in with that one. We had a caller, in case you weren't listening, we had a caller, our regular Trucker Rich, whose grandmother told him that every time that there was a launch, a rocket launch, they would mess up the weather, which is just not true. 920 says, Rod, is there any more of a consensus to the possible timeline of the Betelgeuse, or is it Betelgeuse supernova? Is it? But it's spelled like the way he spells it, not the Betelgeuse supernova.
Betelgeuse.
Yeah.
Don't know. Yeah, that's one of those astronomical questions, and I really did try to do better this time for you, but that one I have not been keeping track of.
Okay. 779, this is an interesting question I don't think we've ever had before. We talk a lot about, you know, what's going to happen if you inhabit Mars, and, you know, obviously this has been a goal for a long time. We talk about it a lot. You've written books about it. If we ever inhabit Mars, coming from this text, would it affect our lifespan? So,
you mean if to live there?
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was terraformed properly and it really did have enough earthly characteristics, so, you know, the survivable temperature, enough properly balanced oxygen to breathe, and enough radiation mediation to deal with, then possibly, because it's only about 40% the gravity of Earth, so there's less stress in the body. The problem is, we don't know what happens. You know, we've had people in zero-G environments for a year at a time. We've had people on the moon for just a few days at a time. So we don't know what happens in these partial gravity environments, whether it's 1/6G like the moon or about 40% of Mars. You know, if kids are born there, they're going to be okay, or they're going to have problems. If people live there for a long time, are they going to be okay? One thing that's been suggested is either Moon or Mars is a great place for senior citizens to retire to, because you're less likely to have problems with brittle bones. And if you do fall, you just kind of bounce. You don't break a hip or something.
Right, right.
But in terms of longevity, it's been postulated, but they don't know. And one of the things that hasn't happened to the space station yet that a lot of people would like to see is a centrifuge up there that can handle rodents, that they can run for a long term a long-term experiment. It's not very nice, the rodents, but you can put a rodent in a centrifuge, get them up to about, you know, 30-40% of 1G and see what happens over the period of weeks or months.
Yeah.
So it's something that they're just getting started on.
Okay. All right. Rod Pyle is with us, and we continue to talk and continue the conversation. If you have a space question related, 312-981-7200. Phone lines and text lines are open, and the conversation continues here on 720 WGN. All right, I think I'm going to sneeze. It's right there. It's right there. All right. It is the Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. Wildcard Wednesday continues. You pick the songs for us to listen to every morning. Wildcard Wednesday means any artist, any song, anything. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from, pardon me, the 219, the Hoodoo Gurus from Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talked about Australia a little earlier on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Talk line and text lines are open. We are continuing our discussion with Rod Pyle, author, journalist, and space expert. Always fun to have Rod on. And Rod, we are. You mentioned earlier that the new season of Cosmos is coming up in March. You talked a little bit about that, and you interviewed some pretty cool people last week.
Yeah, so they gave us about 40 minutes with Andrian, who is Carl Sagan's widow and one of the executive producers of the show, and she was with Brandon Braga, who's a writer from Trek, although we didn't cross paths there. He was a writer on Star Trek for a number of years, and now he's on the Orville, so he's part of that little Seth MacFarlane cabal. And then the next interview was with Neil deGrasse Tyson and one of the other EPs. So it was great fun to talk to those guys. Of course, Tyson, you know, he fills the room because he's Tyson. So he got started with a couple of questions. There was, I think in that interview, there's four of us journalists, and I got the first question in, and he spent most of the time answering that, which made me happy. I don't know if it made the other people happy.
Yeah.
But we were just talking about, you know, kind of the dynamics of the series and, you know, what had changed between seasons one and two and season three. And I think one of the big messages that came out was they really feel like they've found their footing, you know, that they were still kind of experimenting with things early on, and they're trying to decide, you know, given the political realities of today, how much pushing did they want to do in terms of saying, look, science is real, science is legitimate, science is the thing you need to pay attention to, because they feel like it's getting short shrift with the current administration, frankly. And so they kind of decided to go for it. So there's a fair amount of that in the discussion. It's not just about space anymore. It's really broadening to be about science and society and human condition and all that. So I saw preview bits of most of the episodes, and they're extraordinary. I mean, if you've seen any of them, you know the effects are great anyway, but they've got this one sequence where Neil goes to the World's Fair in New York 100 years in the future to sort of compare it to what the old World's Fair was like, and they set him in that environment. It was pretty damn convincing, so I really enjoyed it.
Wow, that's really cool. Had you ever met Tyson? Have you met him before, right?
I hadn't met him before this. No, we corresponded, and I got close to getting him to do a foreword for a book, but that didn't work out, and so this is the first time I actually got to shake his hand. I did have a chance afterwards. Everybody else kind of scooted because they wanted to go off to another event. This is the Television Critics Award event that Reggie put on. So I got to walk him back down. He was getting ready to leave, go take a plane. I said, you know, do you ad lib much for this show? And he said, oh, no, never. It's all scripted. Really? He said, yeah, why? And I said, because when you're doing these long walk and talks, you know, where he's walking towards camera and the camera's pulling back.
Right, right.
And they can go on for 30 seconds. And I said, your eyes are not moving at all. If you're on a prompter, you're doing it perfectly. He said, hey, Jason, to the other executive producer. He said, what? He said, this guy worked at TV, and he says my walk and talks are perfect. My eyes don't move, so there. Boy, what have I stepped into here? So I guess there was some discussion at some point. But, you know, I think we talked about this before. I felt in the first season the writing was a little too Carl Sagan-ish for Tyson, who's really, he's a 21st century science communicator who's your buddy.
Yep.
And Sagan was a little bit more up on the pedestal
yep.
in that sense,
yep.
at least in terms of delivery. I think they fixed that. So it really feels like it belongs in his mouth now, and I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, it's nice that that his widow is involved, you know what I mean? That makes it part of the family, and it brings back Sagan's memory, you know?
It does, and she was so eloquent and so, you know, everybody's different in these kinds of interviews, but she had been doing press interviews for, I think, 10 hours by the time I got there.
Oh,
this is the end of the day. And she's not young, you know? And she took my hand and said, I just so enjoyed your questions on, but her answers were eloquent and beautiful, and she was kind and made eye contact. And, you know, to somebody who hasn't done many of these things, that may not mean a lot, but if you've done these kind of press junkets before, people are usually pretty torqued out by the time you get with them, and
yeah.
sometimes you get pretty short, snappy answers. So she was just incredibly gracious. So
yeah.
I was really charmed.
That sounds really great. And it debuts now.
It
is it? Is it what network is it? It's not. It's not on PBS, is it?
No, it's weird. It's debuting, I think, on March 7th or March 9th, and it's going to be on Nat Geo Network first, and then they think it's going to be on Fox starting in the summer, but I guess they're still working out those details.
Oh, okay.
So for now, it's on Nat Geo.
Yeah, Nat Geo. I was mentioning Nat Geo earlier, Rod. Have you ever watched a show on Nat Geo called Brain Games?
No.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's hosted by Keegan-Michael Key. And it is a show that where you learn something, you have your brain challenged, and they bring in a celebrity and they do all these tests and games with them. And it's a massively entertaining, really fun movie that everybody in the family can watch. It is so good, and it's entertaining and fun. The games are fun. The tests are cool, and you learn something. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's such a good show.
Huh. Yeah. Oh, sounds like a blast. It
yeah.
is a series, right?
It is. It's on Monday nights on Nat Geo, and I've really, really enjoy it. It's an hour long, and all the tests and they have a psychic that comes on and does some really massively weird stuff, like mind reading stuff. And it's so entertaining. Keegan-Michael Key is one of my favorite people on the planet. Is so entertaining and so good as the host. It's just really a lot of fun.
It's funny because when you said it's on Monday nights, I had this kind of flashback moment because it's been so long since I thought of television as being on a specific night.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we stream it now. You know,
it, yeah.
the idea of waiting for a new show, it's like, oh, that's right. People still do that.
Yeah.
No, but it sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. It really is. And you learn something and you're challenged. And it's like there's interactive stuff, too, that they say, okay, look at the screen and try to do this. Can you focus on this dot? You know, and then they do a little tease and they go to the commercial. When they come back from the commercial, they give the answer as to why, like they said, can you see all the dots on this screen? And I could only see one as my eyes would shift these little dots, just like one or two at a time. And then they come back and say, no, you can't see all the dots because your brain does this. And they explain why, after you actually experienced it, you're sitting in front of your TV, actually experiencing a little test on your own brain. It is a very entertaining show.
Now, it must be hard to program that specific kind of thing because you've got to be cognizant of the fact that people are watching on everything from a 75-inch screen down to a cell phone.
True.
3.5 inches across. And I guess the apparent distance would be
yeah.
the same to your brain, but you wonder.
Yeah, you wonder. I mean, I watched it on my TV. I don't have a massively giant TV, but I watched it on my TV. So it was a pretty good-sized screen. So... All right, Rod, we're going to continue here. Rod Pyle is with us, and if you have we got more space stories to talk about, the other topics that Rod wants to jump into, and if you have a question that's space-related, we would love to hear from you. The phone lines and text lines are open, 312-981-7200, and the conversation with Rod Pyle continues here on 720 WGN. And the Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN until 4 a.m. At 3:30, we're going to have a round of Know Your Onion. So get ready for that. Get ready to call in, and you could win. And this spring, Chicago's hometown baseball rivalry heads to Arizona. One lucky fan will win a trip for two to Phoenix, including airfare, hotel, and tickets to the Wintrust Crosstown Series game on March 13th. Register today at WGNRadio.com/contest. Sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, and presenting sponsor of the Wintrust Crosstown Series. Just get to the website. Register right now. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. We are continuing our conversation with Rod Pyle, a friend of the show, one of our favorite guests, author, journalist, and space expert. If you have any space-related questions or comments, we would love to hear from you via talk or text. So do that right now at 312-981-7200. And Rod, we're continuing here.
All right.
All right. So so there is a the SpaceX Crew Dragon, which is cleared to fly with astronauts in the next quarter. Is that true?
I don't think they're quite there yet. They're still going over data. But the reason they're saying the press is looking at that is because they just did this flight abort test, which was kind of the last big test that you have to do before you're going to fly people on it. So basically they launched the rocket, and then they separated the space capsule from the rocket and testing the abort system and making sure that it would land safely within limits of what a crew could survive. And it came down, I think the maximum load was 3 G's, which is about half, less than half what the guys in the Soyuz capsule experienced when they had that abort last year. So yeah, it passed the flying colors, and that's good because it had been a bit of a rocky road for that that program for a couple of years with the parachute problems and so forth. So it looks like they're on the path. So if they get the rest of the data reduced and it looks good, then I think they're home free and next quarter should be it. Yeah,
and they've picked the two astronauts that are going to be the first to fly in the Crew Dragon, correct?
Yeah, and I mean they're NASA astronauts, but it's so weird to see them wearing the SpaceX spacesuit, because this isn't an EVA suit, it's just a pressure suit to protect you during launch and reentry, right? So
yeah,
you don't have to be able to go out and move around or walk on the surface of the moon or anything. It's just there to keep your body safe if the spacecraft depressurizes. But that said, Musk allegedly anyway hired the same guy that designed the Iron Man outfit for the Marvel movies to design his spacesuit, and it's really cool looking. Now Boeing, of course, has their own spacesuit, because they each made spacesuits that were, you know, relevant and appropriate for their spacecraft. Theirs is blue and bulky and looks much more like an old NASA moon suit if you made it blue. But the SpaceX one is kind of sleek and it's black and it's got a racing stripe down the side and the helmet's very hip looking. And I just thought, well, you saw it when they launched the Falcon Heavy and they had Starman sitting in the Tesla Roadster
right.
with that spacesuit.
Right.
And it's kind of slimming, you know? So pretty cool. I might even be able to fit in the thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, Elon Musk, man. Just every time we have you on, there's always something to say about him.
Well, and he's always making news, you know? It's not always good news, but he's always making news. The last thing I think I saw, it was some, you know, a little bit of a gossip column somewhere talking about, oh, he's between relationships again, and, you know, he's sleeping at the office and all that. But, you know, he may just be sleeping at the office because he's that dedicated to his work and he's busy. And the guy's running 3 or 4 companies, right?
Yeah.
So my kid's actually applying for a job over at SpaceX. So I said, well, just be sure, you know what you're getting into. Talk to people working there, because he expects the same performance out of you that he's willing to give, and it's total devotion. Yeah. I mean, it's tough. So it would be the most exciting place to be, but you got to be up for it.
Wow. Okay. Well, good luck on that.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see.
All right. Okay. You mentioned Boeing and their suits. Now there's a big U.S. House of Representatives released the HR 566. And they want the program to go over to Boeing. What's going on there? Tell everybody about this story.
So a couple days ago, Jim Bridenstine, chief of NASA, comes out and says, we're on track, we're moving forward, we're looking to our moon landing in 2024. We didn't get quite as much money as we wanted, but, you know, it's a difference of $500 million out of a $22 billion budget. So the lunar lander program got shorted a bit, but everything's looking good. Happy days, fist of the air, you know. 2 days later, the House releases House Bill 5666, which, yeah, these things are always complicated. It's 102 pages. There's a lot in there. But basically, it slams on the brakes and does this U-turn of saying, you know, let's push the moon off to 2028. We'll keep the space station longer, because that'll, and I'm guessing here. I'm backfilling a bit, but that'll keep those constituents in my district happy. And let's you know, slow down this moon thing. Yeah, we'll do one or two missions a year. They want NASA to use the SLS primarily, which is, of course, their big government program. So it kind of pushes a lot of the commercial enterprise out the door and de-emphasizes the moon and says, we'll do the moon, but only once or twice a year because it's really just a stepping stone to Mars. So we're back to this Mars first, Mars is everything kind of idea for human spaceflight. And this is what we did between the shuttle and during and up to the Asteroid Redirect project was Journey to Mars, this big idea that we're going to be there sometime in the 2030s. Well, nothing much happened. It was just kind of a conversation with a little bit of research behind it. So one can't help but feel that there's some not great motivations behind this U-turn. And I swear to God, you know, if we pivot one more time, oh, no, we're just kidding about the moon. We're going to go to Mars, but we'll still kind of do the moon on the way. I think people are going to lose a lot of faith in NASA. And the sad part is, it's not NASA's fault.
Yeah.
You know, they get told by the government what to do. And this is a bill, and it's going to get marked up tomorrow, so it'll probably change a little bit. But it's a really dramatic, drastic shift. And I'm looking for more data on it to try and figure out what the motivations are, other than the obvious kind of pandering to your district. But it's got a lot of people really upset. The NSS just put out a policy statement on it, a press release that I helped draft yesterday, basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, this is a little wrong-headed, and we'd like to revisit this, and happy to help if you'll ask. But, the moon by 2024 felt a little aggressive, but this feels like it's going way too far the other way for me.
Yeah. And how have other reactions been to this?
Kind of across the map, but most of the space press that I've read is kind of scratching their head going, why? Mm-hmm. You know, other than the obvious reasons we suspect, like, you know, keeping some of the major aerospace contractors happy and some of your districts happy, what's good in this? They do have one thing in there that's kind of interesting where they're saying, you know, we'll still do the Lunar Gateway, which is this space station that we're planning to put in orbit around the moon, a smaller space station, but let's open up where it can go. Maybe it's lunar orbit, maybe it's high Earth orbit, maybe it's one of these stable Lagrange points out between the Earth and the Moon in this area called cislunar space. And there's something to be said for that because now you've got a space station that's kind of moving towards the idea of being a large spaceship. And now that's something that you can evolve into a Mars craft. But you don't have to do it that way. So while it's kind of a compelling thought, the price of everything else in that bill is just too high for me anyway.
Okay. All right.
And it puts off, you know, they're saying Mars by 2033, but you know how these things go. It could be much later.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the latest piece of news. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here on 720. Rod Pyle is our guest. We're talking about space. He's an author, a journalist, and a space expert. And if you want to jump in on the conversation, talk or text, we welcome that at 312-981-7200. You wanted to mention the sidelining of the Curiosity rover due to a glitch. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah. This isn't a big story, but a few days ago, a story broke, you know, Curiosity stuck. And I thought, oh, God, I hope that it gets stuck in soft sand or something like happened with the Spirit rover. But it turned out that during a software boot up cycle on one of the computers, they got two computer banks, it skipped a step that relates to orientation. So it just lost its bearings for a day. And when it does that, it has to know where it is, not so much for navigating while it's driving, although that's important, but it's got cameras that will tell it how to avoid hazards, even if it's a few degrees off where it thinks it is. But if you're using the robotic arm and there are any rocks nearby, which is basically what Mars is, just a collection of red rocks, if you don't know exactly where you are in relation to the features around you and you bump that arm on something, you can strip the gears and the end of it. So it automatically shut down. There are some concerns about how big a glitch this might be, but it turns out as of today, they had gotten it fixed and it's back in operation. So it just parked it for a couple of days.
Oh.
And we're up to 7.5 years now. So this is
Seven and a half years. Wow.
Yeah, driving in one crater.
Wow.
Kind of limits the scenery, but Opportunity still got it beat. And now we got another one going up this year, Mars 2020 rover that they're trying to name, I think this month they're going to do a name selection.
We've talked about this in the past. And we don't know who names these things. Is it by committee? Do they sit down and like throw names around?
No, they're kids.
their kids.
They do contests at elementary school.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
And so they get names for kids. So what was her name? Clara Ma, the Chinese-American student who came up with the name Curiosity for that rover. And Mars 2020 has been trundling along for, you know, a decade now in preparation with the moniker to Mars 2020. They said, we really need a cool name for it.
Yeah.
And I thought, there's an experiment on it to convert Martian atmosphere into a little bit of oxygen. It's just to see if we can do it. The experiment's called MOXIE, and I thought MOXIE would make a great name for a rover, but I guess you can't double dip. So they're looking at tenacity and fortitude and endurance and, you know, all those kind of noble.
Sure.
Square rig British ship names, but they're all good. So whichever one they pick, I'm sure it'll be very cool.
We'll keep our eye on that.
What would you name it?
Oh, I don't know. I kind of like when you said endurance, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'd name it Nick.
Oh, you'd just name it Nick. All right.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure people will be thrilled. Thrilled with that.
Well, it'll go much longer than we plan it to. And every time I see a picture of you, you look like you're about 38, which irritates me to no end, given that we're not that far apart in age, but 9 years. So, I think it would be good. It would be good juju to name it Nick, because that means it's going to run for a long, long, long time.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. All right. Rod Pyle is with us, and we continue the conversation here. If you want to jump in, a few more minutes with Rod, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, any space-related questions or issues, 312-981-7200. Our visit with Rod continues on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio. We're here until 4 o'clock, and then we'll head over to Bradley Place, and our TV crew over at Channel 9 will deliver some early morning news for you. And then at 5 o'clock, our morning drive is, of course, the great Bob Surratt. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 as we continue. We're going to play a round of Know Your Onion. That's where Tom will... We'll get a couple of callers on the air. Tom will ask them or read a newspaper headline, and you have to guess whether it is real or from the satirical newspaper, The Onion, a little game we play. So that's coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are going to talk about iconic Hollywood couples, because on this date, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward were married, and that became a pretty legendary Hollywood couple and a legendary marriage that lasted a lot longer than most marriages last in Hollywood. So we'll talk about that, too. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Rod Pyle is with us. Rod is an author and a journalist, the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and a space expert. And we continue our conversation with Rod. Rod, all right. Hey, tell everybody about Ad Astra.
Ad Astra is the quarterly magazine of the National Space Society, which I was pleasured to take over about 2 years ago. And it's about 60 pages of space goodness. But the good part is we've only got about 3 pages of ads in the whole thing. So every time I pick up a major market magazine now, even the space ones, you know, you're flipping past ads and those little subscription cards are falling out.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, this is not a pleasant experience. Now I know why everybody reads everything online.
Yeah.
We try and keep it kind of pure. So it's got usually 4 feature stories and about 8 other stories, and then a bunch of smaller things in it. And we really try and focus on general space stories without heading off too far in one direction. I mean, there is kind of an overarching theme of space settlement and human spaceflight in it. But I do get in stuff on the robotic programs. I get in some stuff on politics. I get in, of course, some National Space Science Space Society activities. And some politics. So we do try to cover the gamut, and it's just really a pleasure to do.
Well,
I've really been digging it.
Yeah, you do a great job with it. It's Ad Astra's great. It's great. So
thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, have you seen the logo for the Space Force?
No, I've seen the logo. I've seen the Woodland camo uniforms. So the Air Force announces, okay, Space Force is coming. You know, we're doing it. We got the money. It's going to be part of the Air Force, at least for now. Yay, 6th branch of the service. And we're finally getting our space mandate that we've been trying to get since, you know, the 1940s. And they have had a thing called Space Command since 1982, which overseas, you know, national security satellites and launches and all that. But this is, you know, finally coalescing at the one very cool spot.
Right.
So you got to have an appropriately cool logo and uniform.
Right.
So they came out with this logo that looked kind of like the Starfleet patch.
It does. It looks a lot. It looks a lot like the Starfleet logo.
But in their defense, it also looks a lot like the Space Command logo, which dates back, like I said, to 82, which is still post-Star Trek. So it's an arrowhead with kind of something orbiting around it, and then some gooligotsets around that. Of course, the second they announced they're going to do this a couple of years ago, people were designing patches like mad. Most of them were pretty silly, you know, little cartoony rockets with ray guns mounted on the front and stuff. There were a few people that did some really imaginative things. But I guess, you know, if you're tailoring this to the branch of the military, you've got to be a little conservative. What did puzzle a lot of people was the Woodland uniforms, because
yeah,
I know that you and I both were figuring it's going to look like the Mars Republic uniforms from The Expanse, right? They're going to be black with silver piping around the neck and you know, red emblems on them or something. The point that the general made when he was talking about this announcement and some of the pushback is, look, these guys aren't going to be flying for years, if not decades. They're going to be operating this stuff on the Earth, so they're in Earth combat environments. So anywhere from an office in Arlington, Virginia, to maybe a forward center somewhere if they're operating something that's directly over a battle zone. So they just adopted the same fatigues as everybody else, which made a lot of sense. It just wasn't as cool as we'd hoped.
Yeah. Okay. And
that's very subjective, I admit.
Now, you mentioned The Expanse, and I still haven't watched it yet, but Tom is obsessed with it.
Good for Tom.
Yeah. Tom loves it.
Yeah. I even downloaded the audiobook for the first Expanse novel because I just enjoyed it so much that I want to relive it in the actual words of the book. But it's like one of the best space shows I've seen since Star Trek The Next Generation, probably.
When is Rod, tell us when it's on and all that stuff. So
I watch it on Amazon Prime, so I'm not
right.
sure.
That's what it's, it is.
Of course,
yeah.
it's an Amazon show now. Yeah, that's
it was
right.
saved from sci-fi.
So season 4 just came out, and you know, it's funny because the budgets are up, from what I understand, because, you know, Bezos really committed to it. But kind of like Lost in Space in seasons 2 and forever, they are down on the planet. And most of the action was staying on the planet this time. And I had this deja vu of, okay, the Jupiter 2 has crashed again, staying on the planet with the cardboard trees. You know,
right.
I mean, it didn't look like that, but it was kind of this idea of, oh, let's get back into space and shoot people because it's kind of cool up there the way you do that.
Yeah.
But it was really good. I have to, just going back to what Tom was saying, I too, having watched now all 4 seasons to their completion, thought, you know, this stuff that it gets very complicated. There's a lot of interleaving in the show and a lot of subplots. So I went back and started reading the books, which are very well written, by a guy named James Corey, but it's actually a nom de plume for 2 science fiction writers who also work on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So very well written. But now you're getting all the details, the backstory. So I read the books and then watched the episodes again, kind of lockstep, because I'm obsessive compulsive, and I thought it would be fun. And it really did fill in a lot of the blanks, and I enjoyed it a lot more that way. So, Tom, you're right on it, man. That's the way to do it.
So Amazon Prime.
And Nick, you got to see it.
Yeah.
You really got to check it out.
Yeah. I haven't watched it yet. But Tom came in raving about it one night. And
now, was he raving all the time, or he was just raving that one?
No,
that one night?
But he was particularly raving about The Expanse, and particularly, like, you know, you have to watch this. Rod is completely right about it. It's great, and he's nuts about it.
Well, and I've had a number of friends, including my aforementioned son, that I've turned on to it, who were kind of, I watched a couple episodes of the first season, I didn't really get it, and I said, I gave him the same advice I got from a bunch of other people when I had that same response. I said, just give it till season 2, or just jump into season 2 and then see if you want to go back, because it really picks up in season 2. And the dynamics of how they handle spaceflight, even if you're not a geek like myself, but the fact that, you know, they burn the rocket engines to accelerate halfway to the destination, then flip around and decelerate the rest of the way, and all the stuff that's involved with that. They actually observe 0G. But the coolest part for us, you know, hardcore sci-fi fanatics, is when they're in close combat with another spacecraft, they're not using phasers or photon torpedoes. They're using Gatling guns. And you can see these tracer rounds going out and swinging back and forth as they're ripping holes in other spaceships. So, well, I'm not, you know, a big fan of the reality of space combat in science fiction. It's a lot of fun to see it done that way.
Yeah, well, that seems pretty cool. Yeah, it seems pretty cool. And lots of people are watching it. It's a very popular show.
Incredibly popular.
Yeah.
It's like Game of Thrones in space in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but it's anything. It was Game of Thrones one of the most popular shows in history by the time it was all wrapped up?
Well, yeah. I mean, this finale that HBO just had was just, it was like the top news story. Mm-hmm. I mean, we covered it live.
Yeah, we did.
We covered it live on the station.
Yeah, Ro did.
Yeah,
Ro did.
Yeah. Ro Khan, who was our afternoon drive guy, he and Richard Roper and the rest of the crew.
That's hilarious.
They covered it live from 9 to 10.
But a lot of people were kind of bent, right?
A lot of people, including Tom, was a big Game of Thrones fan. You were disappointed with the finale, right?
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed. Although it's funny, there is a connection between The Expanse in Game of Thrones, insofar as, you know, Rod, you mentioned that James S.A. Corey, the pet name for the authors, the two authors, Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank. Ty Frank was a personal assistant to George R.R. Martin.
Is that right?
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So I think, and George R.R. Martin has a quote on the books, like about how this is how space opera should be written. And really reading it, you can see the influence
of
how it's written compared to like how Game of Thrones is written. There's bad language, there's sex, there's violence, you know,
yeah,
but still put in a really good package.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's The Expanse. I'll get to it. I promise. I promise I'll get to it after I watch.
Okay. Well, we're going to hold you to that.
After I watch Interstellar again.
I knew you were going to go there.
They'll probably, been had.
You know, probably because of people like you, they'll make a sequel, and I'll have to sit through another 3 hours of Matthew McConaughey strutting with his chin out looking for Matt Damon so he can smack him in the face for 20 minutes. Just me.
Yeah, all right, okay. What do you got brewing next, Rod? What are you working on?
Well, I'm just putting together the last touches on the current issue of the magazine, and then I'll start immediately on the next one, and then I'm working on a book, which I think I've talked about before. I'm taking a long term on this one, because normally the contracts are like 4 to 6 months. It's just too fast. So I said, okay, I'm going to do this one in spec and sell it later. So I'm working on a book about living off planet, which I think is going to involve it largely about Mars, but also the moon and orbital outpost, but I think it's going to involve going up the Arctic for a couple of weeks and maybe going down the Atacama Desert for a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And maybe Hawaii for a couple of weeks, because I want to go to these simulation stations. A dear friend of mine named Pascal Lee built a base up in the high Arctic on Devon Island as a Mars simulation base, and it's got some NASA funding and so forth.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to go up for his summer field season and spend some time up there and just see what it's like. So,
sounds cool.
You should come too.
Keep us updated, Rod. Keep us updated, Rod, and we will talk to you next time.
Awesome. Take care, Nick.
All right, man. Rod Pyle, one of my favorite guests. The Nick DiGilio Show continues with the news after this.